Well, today we finish up our series on the book of Esther. Last week, if you'll recall, we saw this counter decree of Mordecai enabling the Jews to protect themselves, to defend themselves. But it's important to see that neither the death of Haman nor the counter edict fully removed the threat of annihilation, which is hanging over the heads of the covenant community. So for 9 months, what happens is you have these two competing edicts going forth, right? Two proclamations before the day of judgment and war. And that suspense, right, between the already decisive action, which has been taken in the palace with Mordecai's exaltation and Haman's downfall, between that already and the not yet, right, of a world that's still hostile, still alive with the possibility of war, that suspense resolves itself finally today in the text. And with that, we'll make 3 points. They're on page 4 of your outline, the headline of your bulletin, the headline, the holy war, and the holiday. So first, the headline. So the 13th day of the 12th month is the day of the original edict by Haman, right? You'll recall this. And it is also the day of the counter edict for the Jews' defense. That day now arrives. We're at that day. And so there's going to be a resolution of the two edicts, a resolution paid for in blood, right? This was the day the enemies of the Jews hoped to overpower them. But now the text says the reverse occurred. That's the very theme of the book. The tables were turned. The Jews got the upper hand on those who hated them. So there it is. Already, you know the outcome of the war, right? It's reported in a journalistic, like, matter-of-fact way. The Jews throughout the empire assemble to counterattack those who seek to destroy them. And the text tells us no one could stand against them, right? Because the people of the various nationalities and provinces were all afraid of them. At the Exodus as well, you'll recall, right, the nations around Israel were terrified. They trembled. They were in fear, the text there says, of the God of the Jews. But here, in keeping with the author's refusal to mention God, they fear the Jews, not the God of the Jews. But there's a kind of numinous, otherworldly dread, right, that attaches itself to this people and their preservation. And so the nobles were told, all of these political officials, formally charged with the killing, not only do they stand down when the day arrives, but they helped the Jews. Text doesn't tell us how they helped them, possibly with arms, but they helped them. Right. And the fear, we're told, the root cause of this is the fear of Mordecai himself. Not just the fear of the Jews in general, but the fear of Mordecai in the palace. Right, the righteous, vindicated, exalted mediator, lifted up in glory, prominent in the palace. His reputation has been spreading for 9 months throughout the Persian Empire. His power has been increasing. And they feared him in the provinces. The officials did. Now, if you read this 9th chapter of the book of Esther, there's a certain anticlimactic feel to it. The last portion of the book is told without the artful suspense and all the psychological drama and all the cat and mouse games of the earlier parts of the story. And I think that's likely the case because the war and its outcome is the result of the reversal between Haman and Mordecai, which has already taken place in the heart of the capital city in the palace. That reversal between Haman and Mordecai, it simply widens out here. Once the tables have turned at the center of the empire, there's no doubt that the tables will turn to the ends of the earth. So the headline is summarized bluntly and more graphically in verse 5, which says this: the Jews struck down all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and they did as they pleased to those who hated them. There's a couple things to note here. First, unlike Joshua's military campaigns in Canaan, this is a completely defensive holy war. It's war, it's a holy war, but it's a completely defensive war. The second thing to note is that the enemies had 9 months to change their minds. Right, against the clear wishes of the king, against the new regime in the palace headed by Mordecai, against the actions of all the local governors, they still decided, in allegiance with the now executed Haman, right, in their implacable hostility and hatred for the Jews, to attack and to seek to kill them. So instead of becoming like Rahab, the Canaanite, they became like Haman. Right? There are only two options for the Jews: kill the attackers or be killed. And the narrator makes no apologies for the Jews' choice. And that's the third thing to note here. The narrator is not hobbled by modern sensibilities or squeamishness. The narrator considers this good, really good news. He expects us to be cheering as we read, as the Jews cheer when they read this story in the synagogues. He expects us to react as the Jews do, with relief and with amazement. The amazement of a people under an unjust death sentence being rescued. So that's the headline. That's the headline. Let's look at the holy war. Our second point is the holy war itself. The citadel, right, Susa, where the matter's already been, it's already been determined, settled in the elevation of Mordecai, that is reported on first. Right? And the Jews there, we're told, killed 500 men. Now, it's perhaps shocking that in the heart of the government quarter, where Esther is, where Mordecai is, where the king who favors the Jews now is, in the heart of the government quarter, there are still that many violent enemies of the Jews. Right? Which means Haman clearly still has his allies. And his allies start with his own children, to whom apparently he passed on his poisonous ideology. Right. And then we're told in the text that the Jews killed the 10 sons of Haman. And they're all listed there in the text. You heard me read them. They're all listed there for effect. It's a kind of grim counterpoint to the comedic listing of all the king's eunuchs and all the king's legal advisors in chapter 1. This is a kind of bracket, what they call an inclusio. Right? These 10 names echo back to the opening names of the king's eunuchs and advisors. And it's interesting, the names are all said. When this text is read in the synagogue on the Feast of Purim, right, celebrating these events, the reader reads all 10 names of the sons of Haman in one breath. Right, he reads them in one breath to show they are a puff of smoke and they come to nothing. Haman and his sons. Remember, Haman is an Amalekite, a perpetual enemy of the Jews, and this is a limited and defensive holy war against the Amalekites. That's what you have in this text. And killing his sons, right, is a way to cut off all future attacks. And we're told at the end of verse 10 that the Jews, they did not lay hands on the plunder. We're actually told that three times in the passage. So it's important, right? The counter decree of Mordecai for the Jews to defend themselves actually expressly allows them to take the plunder, right? But it is forbidden under the principles of holy war. In holy war, the people of God are the instrument for the judgment of God on the enemies of God, and thus there can be no question of personal gain or of enrichment. So taking the spoils is forbidden. This is about justice. It's not about plunder or bloodlust. So three times, they did not lay hands on the plunder. They did not lay hands on the plunder. They did not lay hands on the plunder. So they report the number of people killed in Susa that same day to the king. And the king strangely initiates this conversation with Esther. She doesn't have to appeal. She doesn't have to have the golden scepter stretched out to her anymore. Right, because she now has a kind of cachet, a kind of power in the palace with the king. And he says to her that he's heard that they've killed 500 men and the 10 sons of Haman. Who knows, he says, what they've done in the rest of the provinces. How would he know? He wouldn't get reports for weeks, probably. He seems kind of detached, like more bemused by the death toll than he is rejoicing in the Jews' deliverance. And then next, it's very surprising. He basically gives Esther a blank check. Again, before she asks. Right? He says, now what is your petition? It will be given you. Right? The tables have turned in their relationship as well. And then Esther asks for a second day. to carry out the edict. She wants a second day for the Jews to defend themselves. And she wants the 10 sons of Haman hung on the gallows. Now, she's been criticized here for a kind of unjust vengeance. But it's more likely that from inside the palace, right, from inside the capital of Susa, she knows there's more attackers. She knows there's more danger. And she wants another day. Right? And the hanging of Haman's sons, that's well attested in this type of ancient warfare. Right? What it does is it sends a very strong message to the anti-Semites and their allies. It says there will be no restoration of Hamanite policies in the empire. It's a grim warning. It's a deterrent. It says never again. Right? It's Nuremberg in advance. Never again. So the king issues the edict. Haman's sons are hung on the gallows. 300 more men in Susa are put to death. And again, we're told, they did not lay hands on the plunder. So, away from Susa then, out in the provinces, we're told 75,000. Now, that's a big empire. But they total 75,000 attackers being killed. And again, you're told there that in the provinces, they did not lay their hands on the plunder. Now, this victory in the provinces, one scholar puts it this way. I think this is an astute observation. He says this should be viewed as equivalent to a successful insurrection in the Warsaw Ghetto in World War II, with the result of 75,000 SS troops being slaughtered. Right? That's the Holy War. Finally, the holiday. The whole rest of the book, the whole rest of chapter 9, is really taken up with showing how this is the original basis for the Feast of Purim, which means lots. So I want to focus on this closing note of celebration. We're told three times in these verses that this day or these days are days of feasting, and they're days of joy. These are days of rest for the giving of food gifts to one another, and perhaps after our text to the poor later on in chapter 9. So we mentioned this last week. We mentioned the already not yet in the text. Mordecai is exalted. His decree of defense is promulgated. But the old decree, the threat of death, the presence of enemies, that remains. And when the enemies are defeated, finally, as here, the church enters into joy and enters into gladness, into her rest. And now the banquets are the banquets of the redeemed. Here, even the feasting in the book, right? The book begins with the empire and its apparatus feasting, and the Jews lamenting in sackcloth and ashes. It ends with the Jews' enemies defeated and the Jews feasting. And this is how the age ends. Our enemies, with their banquets in the mouth of the grave, are defeated. And the church celebrates the marriage supper of the Lamb in the light of God's face. You could unpack the history of redemption from this sequence in Esther. And that celebration starts now. In fact, that's a foretaste of it right there on that table. That celebration, it started even in the Old Covenant with the Jewish community celebration of Purim. It continues in the church with the church's life of eating and drinking together, especially around the table. But this note of festivity and joy and banqueting, this is to mark the life of the Christian community in this age. Right, Eucharistic living, gladness, thanksgiving for God's deliverance should produce an avalanche of hospitality and banqueting and feasting and joy. So I want to conclude with some orientation for us from this text and from the book as a whole. Now, I'm sure you've been relieved about something which terrified you. If you've had that experience, right, a medical diagnosis which you dread, which maybe turned out to be wrong, or a gripping fear which turned out to be unfounded. That atmosphere of relief, right, that you have only escalated now for a whole people's existence. That's what the text is trying to get you to feel. Right? And we have been rescued from our own sin, from our own shame, from our own selves, from our own enemies, from the very mouth of hell, from the death sentence and the edict against us in Jesus Christ. Right? There's been a revolution in power at the structure, at the center of the universe, in the cross and resurrection of Christ. And that should be for us, first of all, a relief. It's exhilarating. It's an intolerable burden to have to save yourself, to have to maintain your righteousness. His cross is the gallows, right? It is the petard on which he has disarmed and made a public spectacle of the powers arrayed against us. And there are powers arrayed against us. And yet, right, yet, we're still in the world. We're awaiting final deliverance. We are between the revolution and the resurrection of the dead. Between the revolution and the renovation of the cosmos. Still subject to sin. Still subject to enemies. Still living in a world very much like the world of the Book of Esther, right? A world dominated by secular empire. A world where God can seem painfully absent. A world where miracles are few and far between. A world where there's no narrator telling us this or that is the hand of God. In that world, it's in that world, this world, that the Book of Esther has been and remains astonishingly a source of great comfort and hope. The book was cherished by European Jews in the face of Hitler's Haman-like final solution. So important was this book, Hitler, in fact, banned the reading of the Book of Esther. I think he knew the power of it. And the Nazis would kill anyone who had a copy of this book. I'm not sure they killed people that had Deuteronomy, but they killed people that had Esther. And yet, and this is astonishing when you think of it, many Jews could produce the whole book from memory. Get that. That's 9 long chapters. The book was so important to the Jewish communities during World War II that many of them didn't need the textual copy. They just had the whole thing memorized. And yet, right, at the Holocaust, we should be clear, for millions of Jews, just as it is true for millions of Christians down to this day, no deliverance, bodily deliverance, comes on the 13th day of Adar. Right, we have to be unblinking about this. The preservation of a people has been and can be accompanied by the immense suffering of that same people. Right, tyrants have their way. They continue to slaughter the people of God. Documenting this about the church just in the last century would take a long series of lectures. Go and get Nina Shea's book, Persecuted. She documents it all there. Yet, this is the joy, the covenant community survives and prevails. Hitler gave a speech in January of 1944. Saying, think of how preoccupied he is with this. He said that if the Nazis lost, the Jews could celebrate their Purim. Remarkable that he singles this out. If we lose, you can have your Purim. And in October, after the war, 1946, 10 Nazi leaders, the same number as Haman's sons, 10 Nazi leaders are hung on a gallows at Nuremberg. And one of them got the connection. As he's led to the scaffold, this Nazi shouted, "Purim Feast, 1946. Right? We thank God, as the Jews did, for historical victories. But for us, the primary meaning, right, the Christian hope, is that there is a guaranteed future, utterly complete deliverance of glory and beatitude and unending worship and rest because Jesus was hung on the gallows. The gallows does not get bypassed for him or for his saints. Elie Wiesel, I'm sure some of you know who he is, a famous Jewish author, Holocaust survivor. He wrote in his very gripping book, Night, he wrote of watching a young child with 2 other children hung on a rope in front of thousands of spectators in a Nazi death camp, and then being forced to walk past the hanging victims. Wiesel says this, but the third rope was still moving. The child, too light, was still breathing. And so he remained for more than half an hour, lingering between life and death, writhing before our eyes, and we were forced to look at him at close range. He was still alive when I passed him. His tongue was still red, his eyes not yet extinguished. Behind me, I heard a man asking, "For God's sake, where is God?" And from within me, I heard a voice answer, "Where is he? This is where, hanging here, from this gallows." Of course, Wiesel meant that God himself was extinguished. God died in the camp, as he did for millions of Jews. You want to know where God is? He's hanging right there. For us, it means this: if deliverance does not come now, or if God appears absent or silent, or if miracles do not intervene, it means that Jesus Christ is with us on the gallows, deep in the fabric of death, as the one who destroys death, not by circumventing it, but by dying and hanging on the gallows. So Wiesel spoke the truth a lot more than he knew. Where is he? He's right there, hanging on the gallows. That victory secures our victory. Right? That resurrection is the guarantee of our resurrection, and that alone secures the hope and the promise of the book of Esther. And this is why, in the midst of a brutal and dark world, the people of God, hounded, slaughtered, but not extinguished, trusting in an often elusive and mysterious providence, the people of God still celebrate. Right? We eat and we drink and we rest. We exercise a defiant joy and gladness. Joy and gladness in this age is an act of defiance. It says no to the darkness, no to death. Because our mediator once hung on the gallows and was down at the bottom of all human misery, at the bottom of our own abandonment, at the bottom of our unbelief. My God, why have you forsaken me? That one is now exalted, and he has canceled the decree against you. He has promised that the gates of hell shall not prevail against his people. He shall come again in glory to deliver us from our enemies. So the revolution at the center of power has already occurred in weakness, in shame, in humiliation by the Son of God being hung on the gallows. And the often silent and elusive hand of God, strange hand of God, right? Because of that revolution, his empire will extend to the ends of the earth. And on that day, we will say, all of history's tables have been turned. And God has given us the upper hand over all our enemies. Amen.